Several minutes later, the entire crew stood around Anya.
From this point forward, we go on foot. I want us to form a picket line 5 yards apart. Do your best to maintain that distance as we move forward. After 2 millennia, I'm not expecting there to be much left of the structure we're searching for, so keep your eyes peeled for any signs of permanent habitation. Worked or fire-blackened stone, unusually leveled land, artifacts of any kind. Everyone with me?
Yes, ma'am.
The team was excited, which was good to see, and even Connolly and his security team were lining up, eager to take part in the search.
If you find something, I want you to call out and then stop moving. Don't move to investigate, just stand right where you are. Everyone else will stop at that point and maintain their positions while Ephraim and I walk over to take a look. We don't want to lose our place in the search if it turns out to be nothing. Understood?
Understood!
Yep. Right!
Again, more than a handful of nodding heads. Satisfied, Anya raised her arm and gave the signal for everyone to start moving forward.
If it is out there, we'll find it.
They had only walked a few hundred yards before Mike called out from somewhere off to Anya's right.
Found something!
All right, remember what I said. Stay in line until we're sure we need you. I'll let you know what's up as soon as I can.
When she and Ephraim reached Mike's position, Anya knew right away he'd hit pay dirt. A low hill stood nearby, a grove of olive trees growing in its shade. Only a few feet from the olive trees, knee-high walls of fitted stone could clearly be seen, even from a distance.
This is it, Anya. I can feel it in my bones.
That sense of anticipation just before a major find coursed through her as she stared at what was left of a house that had stood there on that spot for more than 2,000 years. Slowly, a grin spread across her face. With Ephraim's knowledge of early Jewish architecture, they were able to determine the probable layout of the house from the remains that were still above ground. From that point, it didn't take them long to figure out where the peristyle, or outdoor courtyard, would have stood. Grimes wanted to grab a shovel and start digging, but Anya would have none of that. They had hired her to conduct this expedition properly, and she was going to do just that. If they did find something, she didn't want the discovery of the year sullied by complaints of improper techniques and lawsuits for potential damage to historical and cultural artifacts. Anya first laid a grid over the area, using wooden stakes and long pieces of twine to divide the space into roughly even squares. Next, she had Ephraim take pictures of the entire grid, documenting what every square looked like before they began. That way, they could create a photo panorama of the entire site. When that was done, she divided the squares among the graduate students, giving a set to Tony and Mike, a set to Susan and Rachel, and the final section to Ephraim and herself. Benjamin was tasked with documenting as much of the dig as he could with a pair of Nikon digital cameras, each with a different lens. 2 hours later, they had cleared enough of the surface sand and earth to locate the remains of the cistern midway along what would have been the forward wall of the peristyle. Rectangular in shape, it reminded Anya of an oversized horse trough more than anything else. Only the floor and the slightest rise of walls remained, but it was enough for them to recognize what it was. The group was elated at the discovery. Anya made sure Benjamin documented it with the cameras. She was getting ready to start hunting for the hollow mentioned in the scroll when Grimes walked toward her, a commercial-grade metal detector in his hand. Anya quickly intercepted him, grabbing his elbow to keep him from stepping foot inside her work area.
What do you think you're going to do with that?
What do you think? I'm going to save us all a bunch of time and tell you where to look. But what?
Nothing. I normally use a pulse induction metal detector, but a regular over-the-counter metal detector will work just as well. Please, be my guest.
She made sure Benjamin was still taking photos and then turned back to watch. Grimes put on the device's headphones, fiddled with the settings on the control panel, and then flipped the switch. He waved the round sensor, the loop, over the ground in front of him for a moment, getting an ambient reading so he'd be able to tell what was normal background and what was not. Then he moved to where the cistern had once stood and began to move the metal detector in small circles about an inch or so above what had once been the bottom of the tank. He went back and forth from one end of the cistern to the other, methodically covering the entire area. When he was finished, he turned off the metal detector, took off the headphones, and turned to them, a big smile on his face. He pointed to the back corner.
Right there. Dig right there.
They found the first treasure cache less than 15 minutes later. It had truly been a spectacular find. The gold had been buried in a set of earthen jars, sealed with wax and stacked one on top of the other. Over time, some of the jars had cracked, spilling gold over the rest of the pile. A talent was a measure of weight equal to about 60 kilograms, which meant by the time they were finished extracting jars, they had over 5,000 kilograms of gold sitting in front of them. At current market prices, a single talent was worth about $840,000. That meant their entire haul, from just the first of 64 different treasure caches, equaled somewhere in the neighborhood of $75 million. $75 million. Anya could barely believe it. They couldn't keep it, of course. Arguments would be made that it was part of the Israeli national heritage, and Anya agreed with that. But the 10% finder's fee, split 17 ways, meant each of them was walking away with almost $500,000 from this one site alone. They set up camp near the end of the afternoon, close to the ruins. The trucks were arranged in a semicircular pattern with their noses pointed outward. A fire pit was dug in the center of the area just behind them, and the tents set up on the other side of the pit, the ruins at their backs. Connolly shared a large canvas safari tent with Grimes, while the security team members were paired up in standard-issue two-man army field tents. Both Anya and Ephraim had their own tents, while the male graduate students shared one and the female graduate students shared another. After dinner that night, Anya and the others celebrated their find, ecstatic that their efforts had paid off so early in the expedition. Discovering that Ben was a fan of American rock from the 1980s and that he had an iPod full of tunes with him, Mike had jury-rigged a connection to the sound system in one of the Land Cruisers.
Come on, Mike! Of course, baby!
No, man.
It wasn't long before Susan and Rachel were on their feet, pulling Ben and Mike with them.
Hey, Mikey! Whoever told you you could dance?
Hey, baby, shake it, don't break it!
Anya, join us!
Yes, Anya, get up here!
The young people gestured for Anya to join them, and at last she threw caution to the winds.
Okay. Well, let me show you how it's done.
Little jiggy with it, huh?
Once, Grimes came out of the tent he shared with Connolly, and for a moment, Anya thought he was going to order them to turn it off and go to bed like a parent with wayward teenagers partying too long. But he simply watched them for a moment and disappeared back inside. Less than a minute later, a sudden, heavy sense of impending doom overtook Anya. She glanced around. Ever since taking up the sword, she seemed to have a heightened sense of danger. She'd learned to trust that feeling, and right now it was blaring away like an air raid siren in the middle of a blitz. Anya spun around, fully expecting to see a horde of horsemen thundering toward them. But there was no one there. The night was as dark and as empty as it had been just moments before. Her senses were still on full alert, and she knew they were no longer alone. She walked over to the iPod.
Aww. What you think you're doing, Anya?
Hey, I like that song.
Anya held up her hand for silence as she turned in a slow circle, looking out beyond the campfire into the night. Suddenly, Grimes was there by her side, a pistol in his hand. Grimes' own gaze now turned outward, the pistol held barrel down in his right hand, ready to be brought up at a moment's notice.
What is it?
I'm not sure. I feel like...
There's something out there.
Uh-huh.
Everyone froze, as if the sound had stunned them into immobility. It was only when the sound began to fade away that they turned and looked at one another.
What the hell was that?
Whoever they are, they have us surrounded.
The thought must have occurred to Grimes at the same time. He instantly turned to the men around him.
I want a secure perimeter around Mr. Connolly's tent 10 seconds ago.
4-foot intervals 10 feet out from the center. Try not to shoot the civilians. Move! Move!
Anya didn't know if that last comment was meant as a joke or not, but she wasn't going to take any chances.
Come with me, Ephraim, everyone!
Anya rounded up Ephraim and the students and hustled them inside one of the other tents. Tensions were high, as the security team swiftly moved to create a defensive cordon around their employer and the millions of dollars in gold inside his tent. Rachel hesitated as Anya hurried her along with a hand on her arm.
What's going on?
I'm not sure, but the security team has it under control. You just get undercover, all right?
Anya looked over her shoulder and caught Ephraim's stare. He mouthed a single word, Giborim, and then turned away to calm the students. Anya took up a position just outside the tent door, her hands loose and hanging at her sides, ready for action no matter what happened. Her fingers twitched. The sword was in her hand for only a split second before she banished it back to the otherwhere. She didn't want it until she needed it. Too many explanations to make otherwise. Each time the horn sounded, it was answered by a chorus of others, though never from the same place twice. Anya had the sense that the enemy was moving in a slow circle around them so they could pinpoint their exact locations. Truth was, it wasn't a bad strategy. Anya peered into the darkness, trying to spot whoever might be out there.
It's a call to battle.
Anya turned to find Ephraim standing at her elbow, concerned as he looked out into the night.
Jeez, you scared me.
Sorry.
A call to battle?
The sound of the shofar calls the warriors to battle. It will not be heard again until the battle is over.
Oh, right, a shofar, a sheep's horn. Who's playing it?
You know who.
The Giborim?
Yes.
You don't believe that.
I don't?
No, you don't, and neither do I. Let's forget for a minute that it has been 2,000 years since the treasure was hidden, and that it is damned near impossible to get people to stick with a task for 5 minutes these days, never mind for 2 millennia. Let's just consider the sheer scale of the task. How would a small group of men watch over 64 different treasure sites scattered across the country? How many men would you need to do that effectively? Every day, every night, year after year? How would you hide them in today's day and age, when a satellite the size of a toaster can see a rock the size of my thumbnail with absolute accuracy? We would have seen them by now, Ephraim.
The Lord works in mysterious ways, Anya. And his people are watching us right now to see how we handle the temple treasure. How else would you explain someone's appearance so soon after we removed the gold?
I could explain it half a dozen ways, Ephraim. But the most likely is that they are locals trying to scare us off in the hopes we'll leave behind whatever we've found, so they can claim it for themselves.
It seemed that whoever they had been, members of the ancient Giborim sect or desert dwellers looking for an easy score, they were gone now. As Grimes ordered his men to stand down and began to set up a watch schedule to get them through morning, Anya let the others know that the crisis had passed. Not surprisingly, no one wanted to return to their festivities, so goodnights were exchanged, and the group headed off to their respective tents. Anya washed up, undressed, then pulled on the t-shirt and sweats she wore for sleeping in the field. She slipped into her sleeping bag and doused the campfire. But as she lay there, her thoughts kept drifting back to the sound of the horns in the night and the explanation Ephraim had given for them.
A call to battle. But a battle for what?
Sleep was a long time coming. In their tent, Connolly stared at his second-in-command and wondered if the desert sun was starting to get to him.
I'm telling you, she had a sword. The same freaking sword she had in the museum. It was there 1 second and gone the next.
What do you mean it was gone? Did you put it down?
No. If I hadn't seen it with my own eyes, I wouldn't have believed it. But I'm telling you that the sword appeared out of nowhere and then vanished just like that.
Hardly sounds possible, does it?
I know what it sounds like, Mitchell. I know it sounds absolutely crazy, but I saw it. Not once, but twice. First in the museum and now here.
Relax. I trust you. If you say you saw it, then you saw it. We both know there are weirder things than a sword that appears and disappears. Listen, I want Creed and the old man to translate the 27th stanza in the morning. Wherever it tells us to go, that's where we're headed.
I'm not so sure that's a good idea.
And why's that?
We're not ready, that's why. We've only tested one of their interpretations of the stanzas. They might have gotten lucky, and if so, we'd be off on some wild goose chase. That's what we hired her to avoid, remember?
Point taken. Go on.
We should try again. Sure, we can get them to translate the staff stanza, but we'll get them to work on a couple at the same time. Not let them know the significance of the treasure in stanza 27. Then follow another trail. At least once, maybe twice, even three times. The staff isn't going anywhere, boss. We can afford to do this right. When we're certain their methods work, we'll get them to give us the location, and then we'll get rid of them once and for all.
As much as Connolly didn't want to admit it, Grimes was right. They shouldn't rush. Do it right the first time, his father had always told him as a boy, and you won't have to do it again. He'd created his fortune by only doing things once. A troubling thought reared its head.
What about these gibberim, or whatever the hell they're called?
You leave the locals to me. If they ever decide to show their faces, we'll blow their heads off from 400 yards away. Introduce them to modern weaponry the old-fashioned way.
The rest of the night passed without incident. Anya didn't fall asleep until well past midnight, and when she did, it was a restless, uneasy sleep. She dreamed of the desert and of fire, and awoke in the morning feeling less rested than when she'd gone to bed. Not a good start for the day. She joined the others for breakfast around the campfire, discovering in the process that Ephraim was a good cook. He managed to make powdered eggs and oatmeal actually taste good, sending her back for seconds. They were just cleaning up when they heard it.
Oh, look!
Rachel saw the helicopter first, pointing it out to the others as it came in from the north, the white EMG logo clearly visible on the black fuselage. Anya was glad they'd finished breakfast. A gritty breeze washed over them as the helicopter touched down a few dozen yards outside of camp. The helicopter was carrying padded lockboxes in which to secure the jars of gold coins that the team had unearthed the day before. Each box would be carefully labeled, locked, loaded onto the chopper, and then flown to a secure holding facility where it would eventually be examined by representatives from Israel's Department of Antiquities. The idea of driving around the Israeli countryside with millions of dollars worth of gold in the back of their trucks just wasn't smart. They just didn't have the equipment or the manpower to protect it properly.
Yes?
It's Grimes.
What's up?
Mitchell would like a word if you have a moment.
Of course. I'll be right there.
Anya replaced the radio and then headed across camp. She found Grimes waiting for her at the entrance to the tent and followed him inside. Unlike her own tent, which was a nylon backpacking model, Connolly's home away from home had been designed for comfort. It had two cots, several folding chairs, and even a portable sink in one corner. Connolly was standing in front of the sink, shaving with a straight razor, when Anya entered.
Just the person I was looking for.
Morning to you as well.
Please sit.
Connolly pointed at one of the folding camp chairs with his razor. He finished up, wiped his face with a towel, and came over to sit next to her.
Coffee?
Cocoa, if you have it.
Certainly. Grimes?
They sat in silence until Grimes brought their drinks and joined them, a cup of coffee in his own hand.
Do you have any idea who or what that was last night?
No, I don't.
Want to hazard a guess?
Some of the locals, probably. My guess is they think we're here to do a prolonged excavation, and those have a tendency to close a place down, turning away tourist dollars.
I can't imagine this place getting many tourists.
My point, exactly.
Do you think it could be one of those Grig something or others?
Gibberim. No, I don't think so. In fact, I don't think the Gibberim or Guardians are anything more than an old wives' tale.
But you've proved in the past that sometimes there is more to an old wives' tale than we think.
True, but this one seems more far-fetched than usual. The idea that a hand-picked group has existed for the past 2,000 years for no greater purpose than to guard some long-lost treasure seems a stretch, even for me. It's going to take more than just an encounter with a desert dweller like the one we ran into last night to convince me that the Gibberim exist.
All right, what's our next target?
Stanza 10, Ben Barakat. It's the site of an ancient Hebrew trading post from before the Roman occupation. It's located deep in the southern Negev, about 30 miles south of Mitzpah Ramon.
Mitzpah Ramon?
It's one of the southern development towns built in the 1950s to house Jewish refugees. We can take Route 40 most of the way into Mitzpah Ramon, but after that we're going to have to go overland through some pretty treacherous terrain. I suggest we travel single file and use the two ways to stay in touch as we go.
Grimes looked to Connolly, didn't get any objection, and then nodded his head.
Agreed. We'll use the same order of travel we used yesterday, and I'll have the team in the rear keep their eyes open for anyone traveling too closely to us. Just in case that old wives' tale turns out to be true.
Okay, fair enough.
Knowing they had a good deal of distance to travel over difficult terrain, they broke camp as soon as the helicopter left and set out across the desert. Anya was in the passenger seat of the lead vehicle, constantly checking their course and direction against the notes on the iPad in her lap. Given the preciseness of the deciphered directions, even a small mistake at this juncture could send them way off track. She didn't want to have to explain to Connolly that she'd led them miles in the wrong direction. Grimes sat beside her, his gaze fixed on the road ahead. They had passed the small town of Mitzpah Ramon a little over an hour ago and had struck out across the open desert in a western direction. There were no roads here, and they were relying on Anya's sense of direction, Grimes' skill behind the wheel, and their state-of-the-art GPS unit to keep them on course.
What is that?
Connolly was leaning forward to get a better look out the rear window. This deep in the Negev, there wasn't much to see except rocks and sand, so Anya turned to look with real curiosity.
What? Is there a problem with...
Anya saw the long, dark line at the edge of the horizon that had caught Connolly's attention, and she froze at the sight. Unlike her employer, she knew what she was looking at. Without taking her gaze off the phenomenon, she picked up the two-way radio from the seat next to her and keyed the switch.
Rover 1 to Rover 5, do you copy, Benjamin?
I copy, Anya. What's up?
Take a look behind you and tell me that's not what I think it is.
It's a Haboob! Moving fast and headed right for us!
Damn it!
Shoving the iPad at Connolly, who took it in bewilderment, Anya snatched up the topographical map from the dashboard and began scanning it frantically.
What the hell is a Haboob?
A sandstorm. A big one at that.
That storm out there is a monster.
Can't we outrun it?
No. I'm guessing that storm front is 3, maybe 4 miles wide, and it's probably moving at 60 or 70 miles per hour. These land cruisers can't match those speeds, not loaded down as we are, and certainly not over this kind of terrain.
So what do we do?
We hope we can find a place to hole up until the storm passes.
A backward glance of her own confirmed her fears. The storm had already gone from being a thin, dark line out at the edge of the horizon to a horizontal wave of darkness moving inexorably in their direction. Even from this distance, she thought she could make out the roiling eddies of sand at its forefront.
This map isn't as detailed as I'd like, but it'll have to do. Let's see, here's where we camped last night. Estimating how much ground we've covered this morning would put us right about here.
Anya put her finger on the map in that spot and then scanned around it, looking for anything that might serve as shelter from the storm.
Turn right.
What?
Anya reached over and yanked the wheel to the right.
I said turn!
Grimes steadied the vehicle on its new course and gripped the wheel tighter.
Where am I going?
There's a ridgeline on the other side of those low hills.
Anya pointed to the two-story mounds of sand directly in front of them.
Get to the other side and start looking for a place we can hole up out of the wind.
Got it.
As Grimes bent to the task of getting them over the shifting sands, Anya looked back again. What she saw wasn't good. The sky all around them was a sickly orange color, and the storm could clearly be seen now. A veritable wall of dirt and sand hundreds of feet high, churning toward them. They had to find shelter. She picked up the two-way and spoke into it again.
Rover 1 to all units. There's no way we can outrun this storm, so stick close while we try to find a place to hole up and wait it out.
Roger.
Satisfied, Anya put the radio down and turned her attention to the landscape outside the vehicle. Grimes steered carefully down off the hill, winding his way between various rock formations and trying to keep the vehicle from tipping as the tires slid in the loose soil. Once on flat ground, he headed for the wadi, or valley, between the two ridge lines ahead of them. The wind had picked up considerably in just the past few minutes, rocking the vehicle on its axles. The air was full of blowing dust and sand, limiting visibility and making it difficult for any of them to see what lay ahead. Anya had her face pressed to the glass on the passenger side, scanning the cliff face beside them for anything that might offer safety. Connolly did the same on the other side of the vehicle.
There!
Anya pointed ahead of them on her side of the wadi. Connolly slid over to her side of the vehicle, peering out the passenger window, trying to see through the rapidly growing murkiness.
What is it?
Anya pointed to a dark shadow on the cliff face, some dozen yards away from them.
There's a cave. Maybe we can get the trucks inside it and out of the wind entirely.
You heard the woman, Grimes. Go! Go!
Grimes was already steering in that direction, and moments later they slammed to a stop just outside their destination. Anya pulled the neck of her t-shirt up over her nose and mouth, and then pushed her door open. The wind was already much stronger than she expected, nearly tearing the door from her grasp. It was only with considerable effort that she managed to slam it shut again behind her. Once she had, she turned and forced her way the last few yards against the storm to the cave mouth, ducking low to enter it. She saw immediately that it was more of a protected hollow than an actual cave. It was longer than it was deep, and the ceiling overhead was so low that she had to walk in a stoop. On the plus side, however, the overhang out front hung nearly all the way down to her waist, which would help to keep the storm out. And the air inside seemed musty but breathable. It would have to do. Anya turned and made her way back to the Land Cruiser, fighting against the wind the entire way. As she drew closer, Grimes lowered the window a crack so they could hear her.
Pull forward about 20 feet and park as close to the face of the ridge as you can. The cruisers will keep out most of the dust and wind. I'll direct the others in behind you.
Grimes nodded and rolled up the window. After that, the other drivers got the hint. All Anya had to do was wave them forward and they followed suit, pulling in behind the others. Their passengers quickly disembarked, pulling their packs into the narrow shelter with them just in case their stay ended up being a protracted one. Anya was about to join them when she realized they had a problem. One of the cruisers was missing. She did a quick count just to be sure, but came up short the second time as well.
If they got stuck in this storm...
Anya took a few steps back in the direction the caravan had come from and peered through the blowing sands looking for the missing vehicle. She finally saw it halfway down the last dune. It was skewed at an angle, and even as she watched, the cruiser slid a few feet farther sideways until it hung there, perpendicular to the slope of the hill. Anya headed toward them. She had to hunch forward against the force of the storm as she struggled to put one foot in front of the other and to keep herself moving in the general direction of the stuck vehicle. She wasn't the only one having difficulty, though. A gust of wind swept down the hill and struck the cruiser broadside. The force of the wind rocked the vehicle up on one set of wheels. Anya watched in horror as it hung there for a moment. The wind whipped at Anya, trying its best to turn her aside. She stared through the storm at the overturned vehicle. She began to run. The storm was upon them in earnest now, and her run quickly turned to a jog and then to a strained walk. The sand and grit stung her face, and she was having difficulty breathing even through her t-shirt. Still, she fought her way forward. The cruiser had come to rest with the driver's side down and the wheels sticking out sideways. The wind was so strong, the dust so thick in the air, she walked right into one of the wheels. Keeping one hand against the side of the truck, she traced her way along the vehicle until she reached the rear door. She was fumbling for the handle when the door opened and a pair of hands grabbed her. When her eyes had adjusted to the darkness inside the vehicle, Anya found Mike and Susan crouched in the cargo space with her, relief on their faces.
I knew you'd come. Benjamin's hurt. I'm not sure how bad.
Anya looked over her shoulder to where Benjamin was stretched out flat on what was now the floor of the vehicle, a blood-stained bandage wrapped around his head. Oh. He gave her a weak wave and a half-smile, which was a good sign. At least he was awake.
The camper case wasn't strapped down. When we rolled, it hit him. He bled a lot, but I don't think the wound is deep.
All right. I've come to get you out of here, but if we don't hurry, we're gonna get buried.
Susan immediately began to gather her things, but Mike hesitated, pointing out the window at the now pitch-dark storm on the other side of the glass.
Wait a minute. Why would we want to go out in there? It's safe enough here. Why don't we just wait till the storm blows over? Surely we can dig our way out if we get buried.
You said it yourself. You don't know how badly injured Benjamin is. One of the security team members is also a medic.
But... okay, you're the boss.
All right. Here's what we're gonna do.
A few minutes later, they were crowded by the back door, ready to make a break for it. Anya was first, then Susan, Benjamin, and finally Mike bringing up the rear. Anya had taken a length of rope out of the supply pack and tied them together, one after another, with about 3 feet of rope in between each person.
Lock your hands once we get outside and just keep following the person in front of you. It isn't far. We just have to keep moving.
The wind nearly ripped the door out of her hands as she opened it, so she just let it go. With one last look back, Anya headed out into the storm. The wind was far worse now than it had been 15 minutes before, and Anya had a hard time just standing upright. She bent over as far as she dared against the worst of the gusts and pushed on. Visibility had sunk to a little better than a few inches in front of her face. They struggled forward. Anya kept her focus, putting one foot in front of the other, not letting go of Susan's hand, no matter what. If she could do those two things, she would get them out of this alive. They'd been walking for what felt like forever.
We should have reached the others by now.
The wind knocked them off their feet, and Anya lay there exhausted.
We're lost. Must have gotten off track somewhere, wandered right past them in the storm.
Anya lifted her head, but couldn't see anything through the twisting, turning sand. As she climbed to her feet, she had no idea which way to go. She dragged Susan to her feet behind her. Someone was leaning on the horn of one of the trucks. Anya didn't say anything. The others wouldn't have heard her over the storm. She turned in the direction of the truck. 10 minutes later, the bulk of the Land Cruisers materialized out of the gloom before her. Hands reached out and pulled them through the gap between the trucks and into the shelter beyond. Anya stumbled over to a clear space. She watched as Hamilton tended to Benjamin's head wound, washing it with water from his canteen, and then wrapping long strips of gauze around his head like a scarf. When he was finished, he tried to make the young archaeologist as comfortable as possible.
I don't think he needs to be airlifted out of there or anything. The head wound isn't as bad as it looks.
Ephraim sat next to Anya. He had a self-satisfied look on his face, and it didn't take Anya long to figure out why.
Thank you.
Grimes suggested it. I just happened to be the one sitting there behind the wheel.
Either way, that horn saved our lives, Ephraim. So, thank you.
Ephraim beamed, and for the first time in an hour, Anya began to feel as if everything was going to be all right. There was little for the group to do, huddled up against the back wall as they were, trying to stay as far from the gritty wind as possible, and many of them dropped off into an uneasy sleep as they waited for it to pass, Anya among them. The storm lasted just over 3 hours. Anya would later find out that it was one of the strongest sandstorms to strike the Negev Desert in 3 decades. For now, all she knew was that she was damned uncomfortable being cooped up inside a shallow cave for so long. She had sand in places she hoped never to have sand again. Her only consolation was that everyone else appeared to be just as uncomfortable as she was. Anya rose to her feet, spat to try to clear the grit from her mouth, to no avail, and then assessed where they were. In the dim light, she could see that some of the others were also shaking off the dust and trying to pull themselves together. Grimes and a few of his men were working on digging them out. The blowing sand had piled up against their vehicles, spilling around the sides and in between them. Thankfully, the trucks had kept most of it out of their hidey hole. Before joining those trying to dig them free, Anya stepped over to Benjamin. He grinned ruefully up at her from his spot on the floor.
How are you doing?
I've got a whopper of a headache, but otherwise I'm okay. Might wear my seatbelt next time.
Huh. You do that.
Even with 6 of them digging, it took over an hour to clear the vehicles sufficiently to drive away from the cave. 2 of the trucks had flat tires from flying debris. Changing them, especially on loose, uneven ground like this, was going to take some time and care. They created a redundant system by using 2 jacks on each vehicle. Should one fail, the other should keep the truck from crashing into the sand and possibly injuring anybody. It took another hour to take care of the tires, but at last they were finished. When the security crew had been working on the trucks, Anya and the others did what they could to salvage supplies and gear from Ben's ruined vehicle, including the mostly full tank of gas. When they were done, they split the load, including the extra passengers, between the other 5 vehicles and headed off. The long ride passed without further incident, and the sun was just setting as they arrived in the vicinity of the ruins of Ben Baraket, an ancient Hebrew trading center. In the failing light, the decision was made to camp in the lee of the ridgeline where the ruins stood and investigate the site in the morning. The trucks were arranged facing outward with the tents in a semicircle on the inside, just as they had been the night before. Their concern about being followed had diminished, but wasn't forgotten. The fact that they were cherry-picking sites to investigate, and not dealing with them in the order they presented on the scroll, eased their anxiety, as did the belief that no one could have tracked them through the fury of the day's storm. Still, Anya thought it wise not to dismiss the possibility outright. The mood around the campfire that night was subdued. The day's events and Benjamin's injury had stolen some of their enthusiasm. Anya wasn't concerned, though. She knew a good night's sleep would go a long way to bring back their excitement. And she was all but certain the minute they found the next cache, they would be back to their old selves. One minute, Anya was sound asleep. And the next minute, her body's natural alarm system told her she was in danger. She lay there in her sleeping bag, eyes wide open, straining to hear the slightest sound.
That's the zipper on the flap of my tent.
Camp etiquette was straightforward. You didn't enter the private quarters of another team member without first announcing yourself and waiting for a reply, especially at this late hour.
Steady. Now!
The intruder turned his body away from her thrust, the sword slipping past him. Then he dropped on top of her. Anya inadvertently released the sword into the otherwhere as he tried to pin her to the ground and shove a cloth at her face. Anya turned her head away from the cloth. It was soaked with a foul-smelling liquid, and even a brief whiff made her dizzy. She grabbed his wrists, preventing him from smothering her. He tried to pull away, but she held on tight. He smacked his forehead into hers. Pain washed over her, but she held on grimly through it, determined not to let go. She shoved his right arm against his body, which caused his shoulder to dip lower. She jerked her hips off the floor and wrapped her legs around his shoulders. He struggled to get free. Anya released her hold on her assailant's hand and grabbed the back of his head, shoving his chin down toward his chest. Then she shifted her hip to the right, brought her right leg up higher, and locked her feet back together again, putting him into a triangle chokehold. His flailing right hand finally found her face and slapped that foul-smelling cloth over her mouth and nostrils. Anya fought to keep from inhaling and squeezed her legs together. Anya rocked her hips one way and then the other. The motion dislodged his hand from her face, and she squeezed tighter with her legs. His flailing grew weaker and weaker, and then stopped altogether as his body went slack. She held on for another moment to make sure that he was really unconscious, then scrambled to her feet. With the sword in one hand, she snatched up the electric lantern and flicked the switch with her thumb. Light flooded the tent, showing her a dark-haired, bearded man, unconscious across her sleeping bag. He was dressed in what looked to her to be traditional Bedouin garb, a sleeveless vest and long flowing tunic over loose-fitting trousers. If she had to guess his age, she would have put him in his mid-30s. Cautiously, she stepped closer and prodded him with the edge of her blade. He didn't react. She poked him again harder. Satisfied that he was actually unconscious, she squatted next to him and rolled him over. She studied his face for a long moment. She didn't know him.
Is this one of Ephraim's infamous gibberim?
Anya quickly searched him, looking for anything that might help her understand who he was or why he would try to kidnap her in the middle of the night, but came up empty. She did, however, notice his boots. Instead of the typical Bedouin footwear, this man was wearing what looked to her to be a pair of good old American combat boots.
What on earth?
She moved in to take a closer look. She doused the light, waited for a moment for her eyes to adjust, and then peered out through the open flap of the tent. She didn't see anything unusual.
Of course, that doesn't mean there isn't anything out there.
Once the sword was gone, she stepped out of the tent. Around her, the rest of the camp seemed quiet and peaceful. The other tents were dark, including the one Connolly shared with Grimes. The fire had burned down so far that even the coals were barely glowing.
It's too quiet.
By the time Anya made sense of what she was seeing, the horse and rider had crossed nearly half the distance that separated them. The rider carried a curved blade. Additional riders followed him.
Help! We're under attack!
The blow sent him toppling off the horse's back. He immediately pushed up from the ground. Anya ran him through, then pulled her sword free. While she dealt with the first rider, the others had passed her and reached the center of the camp. Her warning had succeeded in rousing some of the security team. Grimes stepped inside the arc of an opponent's sword. He caught the other man by the arm and sent him flying in a classic judo throw before leaping on him, a knife glinting in his hand. Two swordsmen advanced on Connolly, who stood in front of his tent holding them off with nothing more than a shovel in his hands. He managed to deflect the strikes with the blade of the shovel as he frantically backpedaled. No one noticed Anya advancing from behind. One attacker's severed head bounced off the sand. His partner turned to meet Anya. Anya parried each swing and then went on an offensive of her own, slashing and jabbing and thrusting at her opponent, driving him backward, right to where Connolly was waiting with the shovel.
The map!
Connolly raced inside his tent. Anya replaced her sword with one of the attacker's weapons and followed him. Inside the tent, Anya found Connolly unlocking one of the large chests next to his cot. He opened the trunk and began moving things around inside.
Thank God you came along when you did, Anya. I found those bastards trying to sneak inside the tent just after you sounded the alarm and held them off as long as I could. But things were getting pretty dicey there, I don't mind saying. Another few minutes. Ah!
Connolly brandished the leather case containing his iPad over his head as he stood.
They didn't get it.
Stay here and don't leave the tent until Grimes or I tell you it's safe.
Anya emerged from the tent to find the mysterious riders disappearing into the darkness on the far side of the camp. She and the others were left staring after them, wondering what had just happened. Grimes took control of the situation, ordering those who were healthy to tend to the wounded after he did a quick head count. Amazingly, they'd only lost two. Chan, who had been on guard duty at the time of the attack and had no doubt died before he knew what hit him, and Mendez. A few of the others had minor scrapes and injuries, but nothing a first aid kit couldn't treat. They had killed three of the attackers. The horseman Anya had taken out early in the battle, the one crushed by Connolly's shovel, and the man Grimes had killed with his knife. They also had one captive, now tied and gagged. The man Anya had choked into unconsciousness during the first moments of the attack. A quick search of both their captive and the bodies of his comrades didn't turn up anything that could help identify who they were. After checking on Ephraim and the others, Anya walked over to Grimes and Connolly.
We need to go after them, and we need to do it now. It's going to be a while before the captive is able to tell us anything. And we can't afford to give them time to regroup and attack again.
You really think they'll be back?
Of course I do. They want something from us and won't stop until they get it.
Connolly, as it turned out, didn't need much convincing. Once the decision was made to go after them, the group wasted no time in getting underway. Grimes ordered Johnson and Daniels to stay behind and guard the camp in case the intruders came back. Ephraim herded the graduate students into one tent, where he could watch over all of them during the remainder of the night. For once, none of them complained. Meanwhile, Grimes, Connolly, Anya, and the other four security guards would pursue the horsemen out into the desert, in the hopes of locating their camp and learning why the group attacked them in the first place. One of the security guards in the hunters group, Gardner, had spent two tours in the mountains of Afghanistan hunting the Taliban, so Grimes ordered him to take point. His teammates, Beck, Hamilton, and Douglas, would be on foot behind him so that they formed a wide diamond. Behind them would come Grimes, Connolly, and Anya in one of the SUVs, without headlights. Gardner would be using a red-colored flashlight to follow the horse's tracks, and they didn't want to mess up his night vision or give their location away to the enemy. While Grimes' men made their final preparations, Ephraim took Anya out of earshot of the others.
The Giborim take their mission very seriously, Anya. Perhaps it is best if you remain behind here, with us, where it is safe.
It's not the Giborim I'm worried about. It's Connolly and his men. Don't worry, Ephraim. I can take care of myself.
The attack on the camp had brought out a militaristic attitude in Connolly and his team that was making Anya nervous. She had a nagging feeling they knew more than they were letting on about what was happening. They took their previous positions, Grimes behind the wheel, Anya in the front passenger seat, Connolly in back behind Grimes. The atmosphere was tense as they peered out into the night, trying to keep the security team in sight, while at the same time trying to avoid driving into a boulder or sliding into a ditch. Just over an hour passed before Gardner held up a clenched fist, and they all stopped. Beck, Hamilton, and Douglas took up defensive positions around the front of the vehicle, facing forward, while Gardner came back to talk to Grimes through the open window.
There's a ridge up ahead. I can make out the light of a campfire coming from the other side.
Well, then let's go take a look.